Topic of today's talk is security, reputation, and ensuring good behavior in peer-to-peer networks. And that's quite a topic which has a lot of technologies behind it. So I will be skimming through a number of basic security technologies and concerns and problems on the internet, because a lot of the things that pertain to distributed or pertain to peer-to-peer networks certainly pertain to distributed networks in general. So a lot of the problems that are found on the internet goes for the peer-to-peer systems as well. So through this talk, I'll talk about these various topics, and then touch upon a number of peer-to-peer systems that try to address security and ensure good behavior and defeat censorship and so forth in various ways. So basically, security is a multifaceted problem. There's a whole bunch of things that you have to take into concern. It could be that, you know, trust. How do you establish trust with someone? Who do you buy a used car from? And so forth. On the internet, a real problem, less so in reality, but still, is identity theft, where people may claim to be other people than they really are. It's entirely conceivable that there are people who are eavesdropping on whatever you're doing online. In fact, ISPs in all of Europe are required by law to store at least the headers of the emails that you send and record all the web pages that you visit. So that's reassuring. Of course, leading to this is stuff such as censorship, where you can be prevented by someone, state, for instance, to have a look at certain kinds of information that people don't think that you should have access to. This isn't censorship is generally thought of as being a state-run activity, but it might equally be the case that some people would issue denial of service attacks of various sorts against people that they didn't like very much. And that's also a problem. These attacks are not only just to curb somebody's right of free speech. It could also be, give us some money or we take your business out. That certainly is things that has been occurring over the past few years. The internet is not a very safe place. As it is, there's a reason for all the firewalls and the all the virus scanners and so forth. Actually, back in the day, there's an RFC, a request for comment from 75 or 76, 74, around that period where the ARPANET was quite young, that stipulated that it wasn't really sporting of people to try to log on to machines that they didn't have any business working on. So, that was, of course, easy to do, but you shouldn't do it because that was annoying. And since then, online crime has moved on and is now a tad more aggressive than it was back in the old days. And unfortunately, we are left with a lot of legacy technologies that are not as secure as they might be, for instance, SMTP, the mail protocol, Usenet, Telnet, so on and so forth. A number of protocols are not really meant for paranoid times where you might want to have end-to-end encryption and make sure that no one is able to snoop on your password and so forth and ensure that, for instance, you cannot fake your identity because, mail servers are and Usenet and so forth, it's hideously expensive. It's very, very easy to fake the headers, just log on to the mail server and send off mails in somebody else's name. So that's kind of worrisome. One thing is that in principle it's unsafe, but in reality it's actually fairly unsafe because there's has been no lack of various attacks of worms and trojans and viruses and so forth that have attacked people's machines as one of the more efficient ones were the SQL Slammer, which I think over a period of 5 to 10 minutes from its first sighting on a single machine till it had swamped the entire internet, 5-10 minutes of spreading across the network. And luckily, SQL Slammer was not very destructive, but a very destructive worm, which we haven't seen any really destructive stuff going on with these attacks so far. But that could be pretty nasty. And of course, there are security concerns with industrial espionage, stuff like that. And that turns out to be a hideously complex problem because, if you can bring a USB stick into a company, then you can carry out all the information that they got. So it's more than just internet-related crime that they have to worry about. So that's an entire different course and talk. And of course, spammers aren't the most pleasant people to deal with, but they're still there. Of course, Dymie has much improved spam filters than we used to have, so things aren't nearly as bad as they used to be. But an interesting thing is that many of the spams that are generated using botnets, machines that have been taken over using these Trojans or worms. And some of these botnets have been used, for instance, to initiate distributed service, denial of service attacks against anti-spam systems to defeat these countermeasures. So it would seem that there's a war going on out there. Establishing trust is by no means easy. In traditional human relationships, there's some trust put into authority. I mean, if they got a great big building down at the Stortorget or something like that, and it's probably a reputable bank or something, and that doesn't go all that well for the internet, because there are plenty of examples of online sites that have been more hacked or taken over or compromised in various ways over the years. Microsoft had their CVS system, or their equivalent of the version control system, compromised some years ago. I don't know whether that has since been shown to either improve matters or make matters worse, but they had. The a free software foundation main software server, savannahgnu.org, was compromised a couple of years ago, and that actually meant that you couldn't check out new versions of Emacs and so forth for quite a while, because they had to do code review of everything to make sure that no one had installed Trojans into all the many, many open source projects that were hosted on that service. So when these kind of things happen, it's actually pretty serious. And someone could, if it hadn't, it had gone undetected, people could have installed backdoors into all kinds of much used software and would have had the opportunity to spread much havoc, because people would, of course, assume that code coming from a trusted source would be risk-free. Another pretty stupid example, but nonetheless quite widespread in so-called phishing attacks, are people who make URLs that almost but not exactly are unlike what they purport to be. So in this font, it's pretty obvious that the L in PayPal has been replaced by a 1. But if you choose your font differently, that is not so easily discernible. And the amount of spam that I get, where people actually are stupid enough to think that, we'll send him an HTML email, and the text will say paypal.com, but the real link will be something else, and he will not know. Well, I will. And that's a whole lot of stuff going on. Some of it is sophisticated, and some of it is much less so. Nigerian spams are certainly an example of the latter. But still, people keep falling for it, so they must be doing something right. Email, being hugely spammed, but if you install enough filters, it's still quite a usable resource, and it's certainly quite versatile instrument. But it's not very safe. It's vast majority of people, myself included, do not send their emails encrypted. So in other words, whatever you're sending in an email should be something that you would be willing to send on a postcard, because it's just as easy for anybody with a little bit of network know-how to read your emails. There are messages, there are methods of doing encryption. You can do pretty good privacy. There are secure MIME. In Denmark, you can have official digital certificates issued to you, so you can communicate securely with the state and everybody else, for that matter. There hasn't been a huge uptake on it, and I think mostly it's down to being, you know, slightly cumbersome in most email clients to actually use these kind of things. When it comes to email, though, the protocol is pretty broken, because it's quite easy to you just do a telnet to an email to a mail server, and then you can issue commands to it. You can create your own headers and so forth. So spoofing an email is so easy, it's not even funny. When you move up, if you've done it once, it's not funny anymore, at least. One of the problems is that with this is that a lot of the email worms that have proved very successful use a little bit of Visual Basic or similar scripting language to go through people's address book, and then they send off emails to everybody. And with the sender's address, or perhaps with purporting to be the sender of someone in the address book is purported to be the sender of the email. One of the really strange kinds of spams I get these days are spams that I apparently have sent to myself. I mean, come on, why would you expect me to, you know? I mean, why would I send myself an email about congratulations, you won? I don't know. I don't get spammers. So there's an issue here, and of course people are quite willing to click on all kinds of buttons in emails, and that doesn't make matters much better. And when it comes to instant messaging, things aren't better at all, because you can still send, say, attachments or files to other people, and you know, oh, look at this funny screensaver, it's really cool. And guess what happens? It's a great big dangerous world out there. Luckily, there are some technologies that can help us in this regard. There are, for instance, cryptography, which is the art of encoding messages so that they are hard or difficult or impossible for people who intercept the message to read. Messages can certainly be intercepted in almost all instances with quantum cryptography over fiber optic lines. It's a possible exception, but other than that, you can intercept messages, but if you can't read it, it does not do you any good at all, except of course you perhaps know that A is talking to B and so forth. There have been any number of schemes to do cryptography, and I will not deal with this in much detail. We have much, much more talented people in cryptography at this place who have entire courses in this very topic. So go forth and have those courses if you find it interesting. Today there's so very well-established methods of doing cryptography, and we have methods of cryptography that we believe to be very strong indeed. A thing that is recurrent in when you're talking about cryptography is when we have the notion of the key, which denotes whatever method you use to encrypt your message. I'm talking very broadly here, there are two main ways of doing cryptography. There's a method called symmetric cryptography, where you use the same key to lock and unlock the text, or the clear text, and that is widely used and has the great advantage that it's really, really fast most of the time. A problem is that you really got to the key that you use to encrypt the message has to be exchanged securely. You can't just send that off in an email, because then people could intercept the key, and the encryption of your message wouldn't do you any good whatsoever. So you don't want to do that. You have to exchange it securely. And, of course, if someone learns your key, well, then you've got a problem. Another way of doing cryptography is using asymmetric cryptography, where most usually you divide cryptography in the keys into two parts: a public part, which are in principle known to everybody, and as for the system to work, it's generally known as public key cryptography. The public key is available to everybody. You also have a secret private key, which is kept only by you, and if you lose that one, you are in trouble. So you keep your private key to yourself. And the cool thing about asymmetric cryptography is that if you encrypt a message with your public key, or someone encrypts a message to you with the public key, only the holder of the private key, that is you, can decode the message and see what the message is. So that's pretty cool. Then we can make sure that we can send messages to one another. As long as we know the public keys of other people, we can send them messages that only they can read. So that's pretty neat. Another cool thing is that if we have a message and we want to send it off to someone, if we sign it with the private key, which only we have, other people can verify using our public key that that message is indeed from us and can only be from us, or at least someone who holds our private key. So these are pretty neat features, and there's much of today's communication that are built up using this kind of cryptography. If you hold your private key to yourself and use a decent modern method of algorithm for public for this kind of cryptography, then you have a very secure system. They are essentially, with the foreseeable progresses in computing, most of these systems are unbreakable, at least in principle, barring that someone makes gigantic breakthrough in algorithmics and complexity theory. But of course, you gotta keep that private key private. And in general, these methods are quite a bit slower than ordinary or than symmetric cryptography. So you probably don't want to be using this kind of cryptography for huge amounts of data. That would simply take too long. So this public private key pair can be used to establish trust is to establish networks of trust, where when you want a private public key set, you get it from a certificate authority, a CA, a certification authority, and they have out-of-band methods of ensuring that you are who you really are. So they probably want a copy of your passport or something of the like. And they also want an obscene amount of money. At least if you want to have a website, then they are fairly expensive. So using this approach, they can then vouchsafe that Bob, for instance, is indeed Bob, and issue him with a certificate, which is then exchanged, given to him by a secure manner. Given that, Alice, another person, can then validate that, because this certificate that Bob has received from the certification authority has been signed by that certification authority, and if Alice trusts the certification authority, she can then implicitly trust and trust their not only trust the certification authority, but also trust their judgment. She can then assume that Bob is indeed Bob because the certification authority says so. Of course, there has been a number of instances where people have compromised the system and actually have gotten false identities this way. But in principle, this is a good system. A less centralized system that doesn't require you to hand over gobs of money to VeriSign is a system such as Pretty Good Privacy, where there's no centralized authority. What we do instead is to establish networks of trust so that people sign two people have established that I believe that Bob is indeed Bob because he's shown me his passport or driver's license, whatever. Then people can sign each other's keys and thereby establish that I believe that this guy is who he says he is. And based on that technology, you can build a change of trust so that If Bob says he trusts Carol and Alice trusts Bob, then implicitly we can assume that Alice is willing to trust Carol to some degree. And doing that, you can then build up a whole network of trust. And then, of course, a weakness is that you've got to establish these networks. So this is why you had at least some cons and Linux user groups and American universities, stuff like that. You will have the occasional key signing party where people meet up with their passport and their keys, and then they can sign each other keys, and everything is hunky-dory. So that's nice. You can do symmetric and asymmetric cryptography. We have ways of ensuring the identity of people, either in a centralized, expensive manner, or in a perhaps less secure but decentralized and inexpensive manner. As I mentioned, the asymmetric cryptography methods were fairly slow, or at least much more heavy lifting than the symmetric ones. So ideally, we would like to combine the strengths of these methods, because clearly the asymmetric method is stronger than the symmetric one, in the sense that we do not need to exchange the key, because the public key is out there in the open. And one thing that is usually done, and for instance is used by the secure socket layer, which is you're using when you have you're looking at a secure website, and the protocol is HTTPS, is that the asymmetric cryptography are used at the beginning of the session, where a client who wishes to communicate with the server takes a random number that generates a key to be used for the symmetric communication, signs that or encrypts that with the public key of the server and ships it off. Only the server will presumably be holding the private key and is thus able to decrypt the message, and thus the key for the symmetric cryptography session has been exchanged in a secure manner. And henceforth, the rest of the communication is done using a fast symmetric encryption method, and everything is nice. And that is very widespread, and there are a number of the systems that I'll be talking on later where all this is quite implicit, that there are these exchanges going on to ensure a safe communication. Something that I've been touching on a number of times, especially in the context of the structural computing, the structured peer-to-peer networks, are the use of cryptographic or secure hashes, and these are also quite central to the system. To many, like not all, the systems that I'm talking about today. In general, we have these very good, or at least pretty good, methods of doing hashes. And in the structured peer-to-peer networks, one of the essential parts of the hashes is that they are very nice and uniform and good hash functions for stuff you use hash functions for. For these, a very good aspect of the secure hash is that it's highly unlikely, given the method that these are generated and the length of these hash codes. If you have two documents that are different, it's highly unlikely that you can make a hash collision. That is, you can have two documents that are different but generate the same hash code given one of these algorithms. So if that is the case, and obviously that's not, these are only 128 and 160 bits long, and evidently there will be those are big numbers, but if you have bigger files, there will be collisions, but they are very hard to find, or at least have until recently been thought to be very hard to find. And because the hash value is then very unique to the message, it can be used basically as an identifier for the message or the document or the resource. And it is used in this fashion, for instance, in many of the structured peer-to-peer networks, and also in a number of the systems I talk about today, especially Freenet. And it also means, because this secure hash is, you can regard it as the identity of the message. So if you have a great big message, it will take a long time to sign that with a asymmetric cryptography method. But you can just compute the hash. The hashes are very efficient algorithms, and then sign the hash instead. That is almost as good, and certainly much faster. I should note at this point that it turns out that when many of these papers were written, MD5 and SHA-1 were thought to be perfectly safe, secure hashes. But they aren't anymore, because some very bright people have discovered ways of attacking them, so that in principle you can create, you can modify documents, add data to them, and still maintain the same hash code. For instance, it's not computational cheap to do so, but it's much cheaper than previously thought, and it makes attacks on these algorithms, these methods of hashing feasible, which they weren't before. That's certainly not the end of the world, because there are a number of other hash algorithms. I mean, this is just an arms race, and there are a number of other hash algorithms that are thought to be very, very safe, and for which there is no attack. So when they are talking about SHA-1 and MD5, you should probably just be thinking secure hash function, and then insert your own. So security is certainly an area where there are a number of technologies that can be used to ensure that that we're safe, and that people are who they say they are, and that no one can listen in on your communication with somebody else. I don't think, however, that it would be wise to regard security as a purely technical problem, because in all these instances, or most of them at least, we are dealing with people talking to other people, and there are a whole lot of instances where it's not, you know, breaking the cryptography that enables people to gain access to systems, but just calling up and saying, "Hey, I'm Bob, a new guy in the accounts. I've forgotten the password. Could you give me the password?" And people will hand over the password over the phone. And, not to mention, passwords on post-its on the screen, stuff like that. That's, it's making it way too easy for the hackers. There are far, far too few hackers that are able to do the Hollywood thing of, they got a password. I mean, doesn't work that way. But you don't have to, when people are completely willing to give you the password. A lot of the attacks that we see these days are done by so-called script kiddies, who just download rootkits from websites, and that means that they don't actually have any mad skills whatsoever. They're just able to execute a shell or a program they downloaded. The people who are writing the rootkits are, of course, the interesting ones, but it's... most of these rootkits will be based on exploiting known security issues. So it's really a case of, if you keep your ship tight and patched, then you are in a whole lot less problem than if you don't. For instance, the SQL slammer I mentioned previously, while highly efficient attack against the Microsoft SQL server, it was an attack that did not affect SQL servers that were patched up, because that was a known security issue that had been corrected. But many SQL servers were not patched, and then people had to pay the price. And of course, then there's the whole issue of clicking on attachments, and you really should be careful. And I trust that most of you are, but tell all your family, etc., not just to open any damn thing they get in an email. That's back in the early 90s. There were an email hoax that went around the blog about a ferociously, dangerously email called Good Times. And I think there were a later version of the hoax with an email subject, Shahina. And the basic point was that if you opened this dangerous email, it would wipe your hard disk and probably destroy the machine and explode your monitor and do all kinds of havoc to your computing environment. So if you saw a message with a good time subject, you should just delete it and step away from the machine. And we all thought that was a barrel of laughs because obviously just a text message couldn't do anything to a computer. Now, of course, that's entirely feasible to do an email that can destroy your machine or at least do very evil things to it. So how far have we progressed indeed? And that's probably not a very good idea to have the opportunity of having scripts in your email. That's, I don't know who was the wise person who thought of that would make sense, but it's highly unfortunate that we have ended up in that situation. Of course, there are a number of countermeasures to strip these scripts away and do away with all these all this malware, but there are a number of issues here. I mean, one thing is people shouldn't just be clicking every damn thing, but on the other hand, it's not so much people's fault that I think that it's the software's fault. It's simply badly designed software. But that was just some general notions of security and cryptography to set the scene for the rest of the talk. There are a number of technologies that you can use if you want to ensure that you are anonymous on, for instance, the web. When you're doing web browsing, you don't want people to know that you are visiting Britney Spears' fan page or something. So one of the techniques that have been suggested is the technology is crowds, which is a system where you have a number of participant computers that are set up to participate in the crowd. And if say Bob wants to have a look at a web page, he'll then forward his requests, and this is all done encrypted, of course, to another member of the crowd, a random member of that, Carol. And she can then either retrieve the whatever it is, the web page, or more likely she'll forward it randomly to somebody else, and so forth. And eventually, one of the crowd members will decide to retrieve the web page, and it will then go back the same way, so people remember what they've the request that they had for at least some time. And in doing so, it becomes a little more, if Bob wasn't doing this, it would be trivial to follow his web behavior, because you could just have a look at whatever packages were passing through his network connection. In this instance, well, it starts out encrypted from him, and then we got this crowd of machines that you have to keep track of. So it becomes more challenging. It's not impossible, because the crowd... The crowd members are known, so if you have enough resources, you can start monitoring the entire crowd, or at least a good part of it, or perhaps insert malicious members of the crowd, and then you have some idea of what it's going on. But it obfuscates to a certain degree the web behavior of users. Another way, a more secure way of doing this, and especially trying to defeat traffic analysis and see who's doing what with whom, is mixed networks, and this is also called onion networks. The basic concept is still the same. We got a bunch of machines, participating peers or mixers, that are known on the network, and all these have public-private keys, and of course their public keys are known. So if you want to use this to retrieve, say, a web page or do something else, you, from the list of members in the mix networks, you decide on a bunch of machines. You plan a tunnel or a route through this network, and you then encrypt your message backwards. And you can think of this as taking your message, writing on a piece of paper, and stuffing it in an envelope. And the envelope is then the encryption. And the encryption of the innermost envelope is the last point on the route. And then you stick it in another envelope, a new encryption, and that's the second to last point on the route, and so forth, until you've got a great big fat envelope with layers and layers and layers of encryption. And the outermost layer is encrypted for the next guy, the first person on the route, and you send off your message to that person or that pair. And that pair has the ability to strip off the outer envelope, because that pair has the private key for that operation. And then has a new envelope in his hands with an address on it, by the way, and can then forward the message, but can do no more with it because the contents of the message is totally opaque. The only thing any mixer knows is where the message came from and in which direction it's heading. But any recipient of the message cannot tell whether they are the first on the route or just somewhere within the route. So that knowledge is not immediately obvious to anyone. And as this message moves across this tunnel, this route over the mixer network, every layer of encryption is then stripped away, and then finally the original message can be delivered to the original destination, and that is then presumably off-band and outside the mixer network. So that could just be an ordinary HTTP request. And the response then moves backwards in the same fashion and can then be dealt with by the recipient or the sender. There are a number of problems with this kind of mixed networks. One thing is that these mixer networks are thought to be, at least the ones that have been suggested until the Tarzan network came about, to have a fairly limited number of mixers. So conceivably, you could just block them all out if you didn't want to have anything to do with that kind of traffic. If the mixers are known, and they got to be known in advance, but otherwise you can't do this envelopes within envelope stuff, a mixer, you can actually tell who's whether someone is the final recipient or the original sender, because you know everybody. So if you got a message from someone who's not in the list of known mixers, well, then probably it's a sender. And if you're sending it off to someone who isn't in the approved list, then probably that's a recipient. So it's possible to do traffic analysis if you insert yourself into this network. So the mixers have to be trusted and cannot and should not be compromised. One thing that you have to do with these mixed networks is that if they were just quiet while there were no traffic, then if Bob sends a message to Alice across the network, well, if we're monitoring most of the network, we will be able to tell that, okay, at this time, point in time, Bob sent a message and it went this way, this way, this way, this way, this way, ended up with Alice. So we would be able to track the message as it went along the network, and we would certainly, perhaps it would all be encrypted, so we wouldn't be able to know what Bob said to Alice, but we would know that they were talking to one another. Perhaps that was all we needed to know. That's not something you want to have happen. So what you do is you have fake traffic. So the pairs are talking to one another, the mixers are talking to one another, and in that fashion mask out the real traffic. And also, if you have the pairs, then it does become possible to because the endpoints of the exchange of messages. Bob and Alice, they aren't mixers. So if you know who the mixers are, you can monitor those guys and then look at what goes in and what goes out, who are who's connected. And unless there's a whole lot of traffic going on, that doesn't that will enable you to make assumptions and draw conclusions on who's talking to who, especially as this the traffic going on, the fake traffic goes on within the mixed network. You know, if these people were generating a lot of traffic outside the network as well, they would probably become quite a nuisance for internet service providers and so forth. So generally, they don't do that. I just briefly introduce Tarzan, and then we can hold a break. Tarzan is an example of a mixed network which is based on peer-to-peer architecture. And the concept is still the same. We still have envelopes within envelopes within envelopes being sent across the network, but they have gone to some degree to ensure that a number of the weaknesses found in ordinary mixed networks are in fact not present in Tarzan. I should, by the way, mention that if you go look at their web page, it's no longer Tarzan. Because apparently they got contacted by the estate of Edgar of the Burroughs family, the guy who invented the character Tarzan, and apparently the family weren't too pleased about them just using the name Tarzan without permission. So this is the peer-to-peer system previously known as Tarzan. They have a number of things to ensure that the system is robust when it comes to malicious peers, that anonymity is ensured. A keen thing about the Tarzan system is that they have a library that you can just use. And from your program's point of view, it's just IP, it's just sockets, or UP, UPD, UDP. In actuality, it's a secure transport layer, but that has all been abstracted away from the end user, or rather the end user programmer. So that's pretty pretty sweet. One of the key things of the system is the way that they have they also generate fake traffic, or what they call cover traffic. But in a fashion that makes the system more secure. So Tarzan, as I said, was a peer-to-peer network, and it's thought to be implemented, deployed in a situation where you have a lot of peers participating in this cloud of little Tarzans, of little peers, or mixers. So. Given that, you know, you have a whole bunch of peers participating, and that makes it infeasible to block them all out, because there would be any number of peers participating. Another thing is that in order to participate, in order to send a message across Tarzan, you have to be a mixer yourself. So we don't have the edge problem anymore, because you're within the cloud of the systems. You can't look at, Bob contacted the mixer network at this point. No, Bob is already a part of the system and is generating fake traffic or cover traffic all the time. So being able to tell that, at that point in time, Bob sent a message to Alice becomes difficult, because Bob is generating traffic in all directions all the time anyway. To get back to the Tarzan network, so one of the concepts were that we did not we didn't have a fixed number of peers, so that it would be difficult to do traffic and edge analysis on these machines. So in order to facilitate that, we have to be able to add nodes in an ad hoc fashion to the network, and that is done through discovery. And the basic notion is this: a node starts out by knowing a node, another node from somewhere. That sounds familiar. In fact, if you read their web page, it seems that they are now using Cord for discovery. Though I'm a little hazy on the exact details of what they do. But anyway, a new peer starts off by contacting a node that's already on the network and retrieves a peer list from that particular peer. And given that list, the peer can then iterate the same process, contacting other peers and getting their peer lists and so forth. And up till then, it's pretty basic stuff actually, and pretty well known from any number of implementation of peer-to-peer networks that I've seen recently. What they do then, which is an extra thing, is that in these neighborhood lists, they have a tuple which, among other things, have the IP number of a peer. So the peer is then contacted directly by the inquiring peer, and in this fashion, you know, you can't fake your IP address, or you certainly can fake your IP address, but it makes it very difficult for other people to contact you later on. So by having this pingback, we ensure that that people are indeed where they say they are on the network. And in addition, there's also a validation of a challenge response where they validate the public key of this peer, or rather validate that this peer has a private key matching the public key that they of the person they claim to be. So in this fashion, the peers can make sure that, well, there are a peer at the other end of the line, and it's a genuine peer with a known good identity. And it can go on to do this for as long as it wants to, until it has amassed a sufficient amount of peers. An important thing about the Tarzan system is the notion of mimics, which are a role that all peers in the network participate in, and that is the exchange of cover traffic. Cover traffic is exchanged only between validated peers, the peers we know are is where they claim they claim to be on the network and are cryptographically validated. And the cover traffic that takes place is encrypted. It's very uniform. All traffic here is taking place on UDP, over UDP, and they ensure that all the messages have the same size, and they go out and basically the same data rate and so forth. And in this fashion, you know, the traffic is just background noise, if you will. It becomes very difficult to pick out that something is happening, because of course if messages are to be sent across the network, then the cover traffic, you know, goes down over that link, so that from outside perspective it's difficult to tell that there's something going on. And all the peers exchange this kind of traffic with a number K peers in the network. So they know a bunch of peers, and they are in constant communication with these peers. If you then want to have a send a message in a secure fashion across the network to build a tunnel, if you will, establish this network of envelopes within envelopes and so forth, the originator originating peer iteratively chooses the peers across the route or to the destination it wishes to take. These are all done across mimics. So we don't send messages across a line where there's no traffic. That's always covered under this cover traffic. Messages going back and forth over these lines, and some of it is actually real data and some of it is just encrypted noise. Using this message this method, the messages can be exchanged fairly similar to what we see in ordinary mixed networks. Of course, other peers could add themselves to this network and, you know, have an IP number and have generated a public-private key set and thus seem to be valid peers. But these kinds of attacks, you know, having inserted yourself into the network would only be efficient for these systems if you were, you know, controlling a big part or at least a significant part of the network. And one thing is that you can easily, you know, if you're using virtualization or just using virtualization of some sort, it's quite easy to set up a system where you're running, say, hundreds of peers on the same machine, or running a large amount of evil peers on a network. That's so you know, in sheer numbers, like, there might be many malicious peers. One thing that would be hard, though, would be to fake IP numbers to a satisfactory degree, because, you know, if you are on a machine and then are running a number of, well, a couple of hundred of virtual peers, their IP, the real IP number, has to be in the vicinity of one another, you know, due to the way we route traffic on the internet. It certainly will be in the same subdomain. And if it's you have a whole bunch of evil machines behind on a local area network, again, they will share a lot in their IP address. So these peers that are to be a part of the secure tunnel are chosen across the subdomains of the IP address, so that we ensure that the peers are really across the network. And in this fashion, it becomes unlikely. And of course, you can increase the amount of unlikely by using more forwarders and more mixers, but it becomes unlikely that a sufficient part of the network is malicious in order to facilitate eavesdropping and traffic analysis. One of the problems with this, you know, it certainly makes a decent argument security-wise. A problem is, of course, that this is exactly throwing locality out the window, because we want peers that are far away from one another, because that makes it difficult for evil persons, to malicious users, to have control over of all these machines that are placed all over the world, or at least all over the IP address space, and that makes presumably for not so stellar performance. Anywho, when we want to send messages across the network, they are NATed. They get a new IP number, just as any router that you might have at home, or we have here at DIME. We have our own series of IP numbers here, as any organization has. It's long past the date where all hosts had a real IP address. Now we use translation of network addresses. And it gets a new private IP address, and is then covered in encryption layers, as previously described. And they have a number of clever ways of exchanging keys and ensuring this encryption. The message is padded to fit within the format used for the cover traffic, and is then sent on its merry way across these number of machines. At some point, it ends up at a peer NAT, where it's sent out out in the open internet, and sent off to a website. And for instance, it could be any other network service. And then whatever transaction is needed takes place. It returns to this PNAT, and then it's sent back across the network and being encrypted along the way. So in this fashion, just as with ordinary mixed networks, we have ensured cryptography, or ensured that the line, the exchange of data is fairly secure and is thought to be difficult to do traffic analysis on it. As it says there, it's secure if enough peer participate. Perhaps it should say if enough peers participate. Obviously, this isn't going to be much good if we have three peers in the Tarsen network or two. Then traffic analysis will probably be quite easy. So this is one of the systems that really relies on a fairly, if not massive use, and at least in a good take up, in order to adjust to ensure the efficiency of the system. The point when it comes to peer to peer, they certainly make a good case that you defeat the edge traffic analysis by just having, it's not a service that you as a client use. You're participating in the system all along, and that makes it impossible for other people to see what's going on. Of course, if they if you have clicked on an attachment in an email and you have a keylogger running on your machine, then everything is up for grabs anyway. But certainly along the way, it's difficult to tell what's going on. As it goes, and this goes for all these or many of these supposedly secure systems, it's still possible for it's a known protocol. It communicates in known ways within the individual peers. So if you have to deal with something like the Great Firewall of China, for instance, or other censor happy governments or administrations, you can certainly, if not completely defeat, because of course you can move port addresses and so forth, but it can be, they're not completely censorship proof, and in fact neither of these systems are. And obviously, if you're doing this because you really, 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 really need to be careful with what people know, that you are accessing these this kind of information wherever it might be, well, perhaps just having the software on your machine is damning enough evidence that you can get into to problems. But this goes for many of these systems. And certainly an example of what you can do with this kind of technology, they go into very elaborate arguments with regards to the security of the system, and I would certainly need more than 3 hours to go into any sort of depth of the system. I'm more focused on the general idea of Tarsen. And the cool thing of the system is that it's just infrastructure. You can basically link it into as a library and then use it, and then all the secure traffic is taken care of, provided that someone has been nice enough to actually have a whole bunch of peers running across the network. If that's not available, then it doesn't do you very much good at all. Freenet is a one of these original and best peer-to-peer networks to ensure a censorship-proof system. It's a system that is definitely designed in order to make it hard to suppress information, and by doing so, it has a number of interesting design points compared to the other kinds of peer-to-peer systems that we have looked at so far. While being highly secure, it also have at least a number of aspects to it that will lend itself to, if not great, then at least decent performance. It does aggressive caching, for instance, of files, not only to ensure performance, but also to make it difficult to do denial of service attacks, so that popular content will be spread across the network and thus be able to get rid of. Another area where they excel is in that of plausible deniability. As a general rule, when you're participating in Freenet, you will be storing data in your system. But in principle, you will have no idea what that data is. It's not in clear text. It will be encrypted. That's both a good and a bad thing because it is plausible deniability. But again, if this secret police is knocking on your door, plausible deniability is probably not quite good enough. And it also means that you don't actually have any idea what's stored on your machine, and perhaps you are then distributing stuff that you wouldn't want to distribute, and you wouldn't distribute if that was actually in the clear. But that comes with this, with the territory of these systems. So, the basic design philosophy is that, free speech is free speech, so free speech also entails that people can store and download and look at really nasty material, and they should be free to do so. Or at least it's not the problem of this technology whether or not they do so. They should be persecuted through other means. Anyway, in Freenet, we also have a whole bunch of signing and encryption going on. And this would, of course, be a pretty stupid Freenet user who would use his CA or VeriSign authenticated identity to distribute dangerous material on the Freenet, because that would probably get him hurt or at least in trouble. So people have generated keys in the system and of course take care of their private keys. And as such, the system is formulated in such a fashion that only the original publisher, author of a document is able to update it and to remove it from the system. The SHA-1 hash rears its head again here in this system. The basic identity of a resource is usually just the SHA-1 hash of the resource, and this lends itself beautifully to validation of the content, because if you ask for something with a given ID and you get the file, well, you can always check the validity of the file by doing the SHA-1 hash on it and see if it matches up, and if it doesn't, well, then the file has been tampered with. All the network traffic is encrypted. They try to make it difficult to do traffic analysis of the routing. Again, using this notion that it's difficult, just as in the mixed networks, and difficult to any peer in the network to tell whether they are whether the peer they got the data from was the original sender of it. In principle, they simply can't really tell. So just as in, and this is one of the Freenet system is placed squarely between the unstructured and the structured networks. It's a semi-structured network because the overall architecture and topography of the network is unstructured, though it will tend to a power law distribution. But the way they do routing on the network if not exactly a distributed hash table, then certainly reminiscent of it. Everyone has a unique, globally unique IDs, and in this case they are usually generated with the SHA-1 hashes. Most resources have what is known as content hash keys, CHKs, which are simply just hashes of a file or resource inserted into the network. But it's also possible to have what they call signed subspace keys. And those are, again, SHA-1 hashes, but they're then done on a public key and some textual description of a resource. So the public key is, well, public. And if you know what the textual description is, you can then search for this SS, you can generate it on your own and search for it, and it can also The data that is stored with this SSK will be a pointer to other files on the network. So this is the closest thing that Freenet comes to having symbolic names on the system. They have the same weakness as all the structured peer-to-peer networks, where all you got are identifiers, hash codes, and where only exact is good enough. And that doesn't make for great search interface. But given this, if you know that Joe has published something on this or something else, you can generate the SSK and go look for it. People who participate in the Freenet system are expected to participate to the extent that they also store data. That's the general idea. So what you implement is this shared file space of peers. The Freenet nodes don't have much idea of the rest of the network. They certainly don't know everybody. They have neighbors, and they adjust their list of neighbors over time to optimize on the topology. Other than that, they don't make a lot of state. When peers forward messages from peer to peer, everything is encrypted, and they are free. For instance, they have time to live, but they're free to adjust time to live as they see fit, which makes it, if time to live was always followed to the letter, then if something was time to live one when you got it, then you probably knew who was going to where it was going to end up, and so forth. But you can't make that assumption in Freenet, because there might be someone has perhaps added a number or two to time to live and so forth. So traffic analysis is difficult. Everything across the network, and many of the systems we have used. Looked at, do perhaps they have routing, searching for files that goes across from peer to peer to peer to peer. But then when we found the resource we want, then we make a point-to-point connection from the originator to the peer holding the resource, and everything is then shipped back directly. And obviously that makes for the best performance, because all the other peers in between are not affected. But that wouldn't be very nice in a secure system, because that would rather blatantly expose who has the file. And then you could do some sort of attack against the holder of the file. So what you do instead is that files are follow the way back across the network from node to node to node. And obviously that is a whole lot more expensive bandwidth. Wise than just doing the point-to-point link. They ameliorate this a bit by doing caching, or at least enabling the peers to do caching at will, so that they take copies of the file as they are shipped back and forth, of course only to the extent of their disk space. And while that doesn't help them very much on the first, when someone is retrieving a file for the first time, if someone in the neighborhood requests the file later on, then presumably there will be cached copies that are closer at hand than having to go back to the one who had the file in the first place. Every node maintains some state. When people are searching for files, these IDs of the files are stored, remembered by the peers, and they also maintain state of which peer it believes to hold that resource. And all the messages are forwarded from peer to peer to peer. So a node cannot, in principle, know whether the resource that it believes is held by Bob is actually held by Bob, or Bob is just forwarding the message, and actually Bob believes that Carol holds a resource and so forth. These are just guesses, ideas of which direction on the network a resource might be. And based on these, this knowledge, the requests will then be forwarded in the general direction of where we think that a given resource is available. If a peer, a user using the Freenet system somehow gets hold of a key, and of course this is one of the tricky bits about Freenet, because you need to have a fair amount of knowledge in order to do searching on the network. If certainly the easiest way to get a hold of anything on Freenet is to know the ID of a file. So somehow you've gotten a hand of that, and that could be from a web page, an email, whatever. So the message, this query is sent out on the network. Local node will check whether it's got that particular file or not. Because initially, it has the user certainly has no idea of what's stored on the machine, but at least the computer can check the hashes of files stored, and it will then forward this message in the direction of the known neighbors that it believes is the most likely one to have this particular resource, and this goes on across the network. Time to live is counted down as it goes along, and always forwarded towards the peer that has the closest ID matching the resource that we are looking for. And we then find the resource, then it is sent back across the same route. At this point, we have one of the optimizations of the system, because as opposed to the structural peer-to-peer networks, you can't just calculate in which direction. The Freenet is not exact. So it's based on heuristics. So you can't just calculate that that direction lies the file. In order to learn what's going on, not completely unlike Jira, for instance, the Freenet nodes stores the ID of the file and the direction from where it came. And a node, as the message is sent back, it can contain where it actually originated from along with the file. But as it moves back across the network towards the originator or the requester, peers are fully allowed to cache the file, store the ID, and to cache the file and or just cache the ID of where its real whereabouts is, or at least what they believe to be the real whereabouts, and claim that they themselves are the originator of the file. So in this fashion, a lot of peers will, in effect, masquerade as the originator, and again make it difficult to pinpoint exactly where in the network a resource is. And adding to that, they are free to cache files as they see fit. And as I mentioned before, they can also add numbers to the time to live, so it does not become possible to simply make some sort of traffic analysis based on the radius of the time or the diameter of the search radius. If something is searched for, it's the ID of it will be populated across the network, because presumably people from random directions will be asking for it. The resource, not only will the routing tables with where stuff is stored get updated, but the file itself will also get cached along the way. So in this fashion, it becomes, when you have a web server which has content that you don't like, it's fairly easy to bring down that web server by doing a distributed denial of service attack, where you just request that resource you don't like a lot of times. even with a modest amount of machinery, it's possible to bring down big web servers in this fashion. Because there's a single point of failure and there's only so much bandwidth available to a web server. But in the case of Freenet, well, the more you request a file, the more it gets distributed across the network. So you end up in a situation whereas instead of hammering on a peer that you don't like, you will be hammering on your next door neighbor in the network. And that's, of course, not very nice for the next door neighbor, but at least the bad effect on the network, or the overall network, is limited to only a local effect, and in that fashion, it's quite different from what we're used to in centralized systems. If we take a look on how this takes place in the system, it's basically a Walker algorithm, but with the added, it's a biased walker, if you will. The walker will always be moving towards what it believes to be the right direction, but of course this knowledge is not in any way perfect, so it will be walking willy-nilly across the network, but over time, the resources, due to SEO searches become successful, they are returned, and along the way, the routing tables are updated, and thus over time will become fairly good, so that walkers are rapidly pointed in the right direction and end up with the resource that they are looking for. But other than that, this is fairly standard walker algorithm. So if you want to store something on Freenet, it's basically the same thing. If you got the file, you hash it, and you then try to search for the ID that you create. And using that, you send it off, and eventually the network will end, the time to live will run out, and you will get an all clear from the last peer along the way that apparently there's no such resource with this particular ID on the network. If you actually were trying to insert a file that was always already in a network, and you might want to do that if you were a malicious user, that wouldn't actually do much good for you, because it's just like a query. So if the only thing that would happen would be that you would get a message back from, oh, the resource already exists, it's here, and it would move back just as with a query, and updating the routing tables, having storing a copy, storing cached copies along the way. So if you try to insert bogus information to write over something else, it won't work, because you'll just get what's already there in the network. And this is, of course, ignoring completely that every forget about that. This is a way to ensure that you can't do a denial of service attack in this way. And of course, you can't insert, and that was what I was just about to say, you can't insert bogus information anyway, because when you present the file, when you've gotten the all clear, you then present the file to the peers and push it into the network, where it will end up at the all clear point. And at every step, the peers are free to validate the file with a hash value. And if it was a bogus file, it wouldn't match the hash values, the hash value, and would be rejected. And the routing tables are updated, et cetera, and it ends up with the place on the network where the nodes believe that it belongs. So in this fashion, as over time, you end up with keeping files that are close to you, numerically speaking, in the ID space, just as in structured network. But this is something that is built up heuristically rather than exactly as is the case with the structured network. A consequence of the system, and as opposed to, for instance, the past system, in the past system, there were guarantees of K copies of a given file at all times. There are absolutely no guarantees in Freenet. So when a file is requested, you know, knowledge about it spreads across the network and it's replicated. But if if we have some unpopular information, well, nobody is requesting it. It will not get spread across the network. Knowledge of it will not be spread across the network, and the peers that are holding it will, you know, run out of disk space eventually and discard the least recently used files. So stuff has to be popular to survive in the long run on the freenet system. But that also is actually something that counts to their advantage, because that means that you can't just fill up the network with bogus files that, you know, they are perfectly valid, but they don't contain anything. They're just noise. You can't do that because no one would request them. And thus, you would, or at least the interest for these files would not be widespread across the network. So they wouldn't get replicated a lot. Then you might, you know, insert files and then at some other point in the network request those files a lot in hope of swamping the network. But again, this is adaptive. If no one else is requesting that file, then it will end up, we'll end up in a situation where only your next door neighbor, and the next door neighbor is presumably at this point really fed up with you, is the peer who's holding this particular resource, because that particular peer is getting requests all the time for it, but nobody else is. And it has eventually been cached at the next door peer. And again, we're only observing a local effect on the network and not a global one. So we know how to find files. We can insert files. Now we want to know how we join the freenet system. Again, you have to know someone in order to get into the club, and you make an announcement with your public key and IP address and the time to live, and this announcement is then forwarded across the network in a random fashion, and they have an algorithm to generate an ID for this particular peer in a fashion that ensures that not one peer can determine the ID. It's a collaborative effort between all the participating peers in the naming of this new peer. And in that fashion, you can't have a malicious peer that, you know, try to cluster key spaces or something like that to insert. You know, you have two peers. You have the malicious peer and the peer that tries to join the network. The malicious peer cannot ensure that this new peer is given a specific key so that it's close to, you know, a document that we want to suppress. That wouldn't work, because you would have to have you need to have the collaboration of a lot of peers, and that again makes attacks difficult. Anywho, the ID is then generated for this new node, and then, well, that's the ID of the node, and it's then responsible for handling the resources with IDs close to this particular ID for all future traffic, and other peers will forward the IDs close to it and so forth. They've done a number of simulations and measurements on the system. The way it works is that, well, as you can plainly see, it would seem that the distribution, for instance, of nodes, it seems awfully like a power law system. I should note, I forget whether I actually mentioned that previously, nodes know only their neighbors, but they are free to... you know, as they route traffic back and forth, they notice that, okay, this resource is often from this guy. I'll add that guy to my neighbor set. They're free to build up their neighbor sets over time. And as you can see, there will be peers that are much more well-connected than others. Their simulations suggest that the system is able to scale quite well. This is certainly a lot of nodes, and this is indeed a pretty good scalability with path length for searches. One thing that is certainly, and this is should come as no surprise to you, because we've seen similar work before, when you got these power law networks, if you do random attacks on them, it's most likely that you'll attack someone who's a nobody in the system, or at least knows very few other peers. And you know whether they're there or not doesn't affect the network too badly. On the other hand, if you're going after the nodes with the high connectedness, then you can really hurt the system and bring it down. And so and this system is no different when it comes to that kind of attack. The simulations would suggest that. Okay, that's actually next slide. sorry, they don't do keyword searching too nicely. It's just like the structured networks; you got to know the ID in order to have access. There are a whole lot of the whole problem with these keys and encryption and so forth is that you can do these kinds of things securely, but these keys and whatnot and IDs, they have to be distributed somehow. It's not enough we have the resources somewhere out there. We need to know how to get to them. And how is that done? Because if we can't nail people on downloading the resource, then presumably it should be possible for us to nail them on trying to get the address to the things we don't want them to look at. And so that's kind of a weakness of the system. They have this notion of forwarding all messages node to node to node to node, and that of course is not too nice. On the other hand, as we saw before, the message, the routing length doesn't seem to be too long, and certainly the caching of files optimizes on this route. Also, not only the caching, but also based on the messages going back and forth, nodes can improve their neighbor lists and build up this power law architecture of the system. And searching will certainly improve over time if it's a stable network because the routing tables are updated over time. If we take some of these characteristics that we have looked at a number of times, we see that at least the simulations look good. I've never actually tried to run Freenet myself. It's a notoriously tricky system to run, and it's criticized for that. But it's in generally claimed to be a fairly slow system in actual use. Fairness, as we have all the caching, it will certainly ensure that no single peer is overworked, even if it has a popular resource, because that will be cached all over the place. So in that fashion, it's fairly nice, and also we get the uniformness of the hash space to ensure that data will be spread all over the network. Integrity of file security, the reliance of using hashing should certainly ensure that the resources that we get have integrity, are good files. Of course, this is pending attacks that you might do to the hash algorithm used. Anonymity, deniability, censorship resistance, all that, those are the things that this system was designed to address. So certainly it works quite well in that regard. But of course, that's the network itself. Getting hold of the keys are one of the problems with the system, and that's outside the Freenet design. So that makes it for the secure systems, if you will, systems where security is the important thing, and you need to have anonymity of some sort or fashion, and it's really important that people cannot tell who's downloading what from whom and so forth. But that's not all that is entailed in a secure system. There's also the whole notion of ensuring trust, ensuring that people behave in a nice or at least decent fashion, and actually that they contribute to the overall good. And that's central to the whole idea of peer-to-peer networks, that peer-to-peer networks only works if people are contributing to the system. If no one is contributing to the system, then there's no peer-to-peer system at all. So we really need to have some sort of way of ensuring that people behave in a nice fashion. And inherent to that is also trust. You know, who can you trust to behave in a good and expected fashion? And we have a whole lot of social mores to establish trust among ourselves. And there are, you know, calls to authority, and at least we can judge the personality of people and trust, so people who our friend says are trustworthy and so forth. It's also a general thing is that trust is not something that you just get automatically, because then people will get burned if they just blindly trust people. It's something that you have to earn, and if you behave badly, then you lose the trust, and rebuilding up that trust again is very hard, as many politicians have discovered over time, for instance. Trust in a computer setting makes everything a bit more difficult, because, you know, we have, as I said, a lot of social mechanisms to ensure trust and build up trust networks among people. When we are talking about computers, so you have the old wording, the adage that on the internet nobody knows you're a dog. That's certainly true. Of course, it continues, but they can tell right off the bat if you're an idiot. And that's also true, but it's possible to establish trusts over the net, and you can do that, for instance, with this pretty good privacy. It's built on layered trust in a network. One thing is trust. Another thing is just making sure that people behave in a nice manner and contribute their fair share to the overall system. And one example of a hugely successful peer-to-peer network, presumably I would claim that it's easily the most successful of peer-to-peer networks to date, is the BitTorrent system. And the BitTorrent system tries to address basically a single problem, namely the efficient download of large files over the network. If you want to, for whatever reason, want to publish a large file, you're certainly more than welcome to do that by storing it on a web server and providing people access to a web page where it's linked, or just distributing the link to the file on the web server. And if you do so, you will discover that bandwidth is not free, and that you will have to pay quite a bit of money to your network provider if the page is to stay up, if it gets a lot of hits. And if you read sites such as Slashdot or Dig, you will find a recurring theme is that some university somewhere or some guy did something amazing, look at the page, and the page will often go down, and you will be greeted by a page that says bandwidth limits exceeded, and please call accounting. And that's bad news for the person who got this page. And if they don't just shut him off, he will probably get a huge bill at the end of the month. So that's not very nice. So being able to, in a cheaper fashion for the one who's doing the publishing, being able to publish files would be really neat. And even more so if it worked in a nice fashion for the end user, so that people were able to use this. One thing you could do, and has certainly been done for instance, the distribution of Linux ISOs and many open source projects, is, for instance, you could look at SourceForge, is to maintain a whole bunch of mirrors across the network, and then encourage people not to download from the main site, but to choose a mirror in their vicinity, and not only because that offloads the main server, but also because it simply performed better to choose a local mirror. Now that works on the grand scale for, you know, SourceForge and Red Hat and big players. They can do that, and they can convince people to mirror for them. But if you just want to mirror or to distribute a file or a website, or especially if you want to mirror a big file or something, why should people mirror your stuff? I mean, what's in it for them? They'll get a warm, fuzzy feeling, but that won't pay the bill. So it's not that easy for ordinary people to get access to getting mirroring. And if they want to have access to mirroring, then it's certainly not easy to get access to free mirroring, and that's a bit of a problem. But if it's popular stuff that you're publishing, then it should be possible to get the people who are interested in your stuff to do all the heavy lifting. And that indeed is the idea of the BitTorrent system, namely that the file is in principle downloaded once from you, and then the people who are interested in are sharing it among themselves. And here, finally, I can use the two screens up here to something, namely in doing this. Yes, and here we have an amazing animation. So we'll just add a server to the system. Hello, something happened, please. Here we have a BitTorrent server that holds a BitTorrent seeder that holds a file. This is the little rainbow you can see here, and we can then add a couple of clients to the system. And I'll just let that little animation run its merry way. Hope you can see that. It's actually sending packages back and forth across the network. This, until now, is basically what you would expect to see in any other scenario if you had a downloading a file from a web server or so. But what's interesting is that over time, as these other peers download enough of it begins to have, you know, sizable chunks of this particular file, they will start to share it among themselves so that the original seeder of the file is offloaded and does not have to participate much in the ongoing exchange of data. Some terms that you'll find again and again in BitTorrent: a seed is a complete file. A seeder is the one who's is a peer that's distributing a completed file. So that also means that once you've downloaded the entire file and continues to provide access to it for other BitTorrent users, you become a seeder yourself. A central idea of BitTorrent, and one of the areas where it's not like most other peer-to-peer systems, is the notion of the torrent file. The torrent file is a file that's generated for a given file. It contains info about the tracker. I'll get back to the tracker in just a little while. Contains hash values of chunks of the file. So we can identify individual chunks of the file of a given fixed size and verify that these chunks indeed are valid by checking the hash value. And then we got the tracker. The tracker is a key component in the BitTorrent system. It's the task of the tracker to keep track of the peers that are interested in downloading a given file. So a tracker may be dealing only with one particular file, or may be tracking a bunch of files. That's really not that important. But it certainly will keep track of the peers that are downloading a given file. So when you want to download a file, you download a torrent file describing this particular file. That might be a something you get in an email, you download it from a web page. By whatever means, you get a hold of a torrent file, and the peer can then contact the tracker that is inscribed in this torrent file. To this tracker, it expresses interest in a given file and is then given a list of randomly selected other peers that are also downloading this particular file. And the peer can then proceed to contact these other peers. At this point, the tracker's job is basically done. So compared to the downloading of files and so forth, the workload on the tracker is comparatively light. Though, of course, if the tracker is tracking thousands and thousands of files, it is still maintaining a lot of transactions and will probably be overloaded. But as such, in considering the single download of a single file, the tracker is merely the initiator, the initiating coordinator between the peers, and after that, all the peers are just talking within themselves. So you join a swarm of peers, and within the swarm, the peers will broadcast which pieces of the file that they have at any given point. And that means that they can then proceed to contact other peers in the swarm that have pieces that they themselves do not. So they start downloading from left and right in the swarm, and not only are files chunked up into pieces are chunked up into sub pieces, and these packages are then exchanged across the network, and this is handled in parallel. And this is one of the nice aspects of BitTorrent, is that you get very high you can utilize your bandwidth to a very high degree, because you're not dependent on downloading from a single peer where you have one single bottleneck. In fact, the bottleneck will probably be your own bandwidth limitation, because you'll be downloading from a lot of peers at the same time. That's strange English. Basically, in order to get started, if you don't have anything, you start off by selecting a random piece, and after that, you will you'll go after the least avail. As everybody is publishing, broadcasting what they've got until now, you can calculate the rarest pieces of a file, and you'll try to download that. And oh, that might seem a little suboptimal, because surely it's more efficient to download what is found in many copies across the network in the swarm. But in going for the rarest first approach, we ensure that we make as many copies as quickly as possible of the rarest pieces of the file, so that later on in the process, the download will commence that much faster, because there will be more copies of this file, of this piece across the network. Also, if a seeder, that is one who has a complete file, or at least has one of these rare pieces of the file, leaves the network at a later point, odds are that we will have replicated the things, the rare unique pieces held by this particular peer. So that's the basic concept, and you can see that going on over here. And by now, they are almost in a stable situation. They all have basically the entire rainbow. So if I add a couple of new peers, they should start to download from some of the well, they may contact the original seeder of the file, but they are also just as likely to contact somebody else who has the completed file. One thing that can happen, though, is that, there's only so much bandwidth to go around, and perhaps not all peers are motivated to contribute, because if they are uploading at full throttle, they can't download as much, and they have perhaps a bandwidth cap, so uploading counts against their bandwidth cap, or traffic cap, so they don't want to upload much. But if they do so, they will get choked over time. That is that, if you're not giving me parts of the file that I want, then I certainly won't give you anything. It's a basic idea. So people who do not contribute are put at a lower priority than other peers. On the other hand, this could, if that was followed blindly, that approach that if you don't give anything, you won't get anything, that was followed blindly, we would end up in a situation where peers that didn't have anything to begin with, well, they can't contribute anything, so they would be locked out because they can't contribute any part of the file which they want. So there is also a dynamic unchoking of peers. Where peers will be allowed to get pieces of the file over time, and thus they will over time build off pieces of the file, and then they have something to trade with and can participate in the network. So to that, they have all this optimistic unchoke. So regardless of how you have been behaving in the network, of course you can actually in many of these clients ban people, but apart from that, regardless of how you've been behaving, you will get your shot at a place in the sun for a while from the other peers, and can in that fashion, if you're not really not contributing anything, well, you will get the file eventually, but it will take much longer than if you contributed in a fair fashion to the rest of the network, because in that case, you don't have to rely on being optimistically unchoked from time to time. You can just move along in the ordinary fashion. You choose not to contribute, you will get your file, but it will take much longer because you have to rely on the mercy and good feeling of other people. And as such, BitTorrent is at heart a relatively simple system, but it works surprisingly well and has found a lot of use. And I could fail be the opposite question this time. Okay, who in this room has not used BitTorrent? Okay, who's in this room is too tired to lift his arm? I think my point is clear. BitTorrent is widely used, and it's widely used not only as a network system. It's of course there's a lot of copyrighted material being downloaded over time in the BitTorrent system. In fact, if I just switch these two slides around, I've seen estimates that put BitTorrent at something like 35% of all internet traffic. There has been estimates in the same ballpark with Nutella traffic, but at least with BitTorrent, this is real traffic. This is not just wasted queries and pings. So that's a lot of traffic going on, and a lot of it, and at least some of it, will be Linux, ISOs, and other decent, good white hat stuff. And some of it is perhaps not so free of copyright infringement issues. But it's only finding a lot of use, and people are more than capable of using the system. It avoids a lot of the... the problems inherent in a lot of the systems, and ARA, this last system of today, is certainly no different in this aspect. When you try to establish trust over time, it can be kind of difficult because you'd have to track the way people behave over time, and that makes things difficult. But BitTorrent is delightfully focused system, because this is, you know, we have this session, we are downloading this file, and you're only judged on how you behave on this particular file, at least in principle. So if you're not actually contributing here, well, you will get shafted, or at least get a much slower download than you would otherwise. In order to ensure fairness, there are systems that require people to sign on to certain trackers, and I guess a lot of these trackers aren't that white hat, really. But certainly have trackers ensure that at, that people are behaving nicely, or at least they have to be known to the system, and then there can be some aspects of reporting and reputation and so forth going on. Now, if you know, you've seen a number of peer-to-peer systems, you will know that we really don't like single points of failures when it comes to peer-to-peer systems, because that is a real liability and a weakness. And certainly the tracker is, okay, it's doing light lifting. It's only starting people up, and then they can work within the swarm to download the file. But if you eliminate the tracker, there's a problem. This has been alleviated in recent designs and extensions to the BitTorrent protocol, in that there's now a possibility of having what is known as trackerless networks, where you don't actually have to have a tracker. You only need the bit the torrent file. They use a Kademlia network for that part, and my impression is that you really, I've been looking for a bit of documentation of what's actually going on, but I'm getting the impression that you've got to read the source to find out what's actually going on. If any of you know of better documentation, I'd love to hear it. But as many open source projects, you know, writing code is fun, writing documentation is not so fun. So code gets written. Certainly, mapping BitTorrent to a structured peer-to-peer network such as Kademlia seems a fairly natural match, because as opposed to many other systems, you know, we start out with the torrent file. We got that one, and that one is filled with lovely, lovely hash IDs of bits of pieces of files. So I would presume that what they store in this Kademlia network are these hashes and their location on the network. And then you simply, given the torrent file, you can search for these IDs. That's certainly, you know, the easy way of doing it. They might well be doing something smarter than that, but that would be a trivial implementation using a structured peer-to-peer network. Incidentally, at least the times I've been running Azureos, I can see it maintaining something like a million or so people participating in the structured peer-to-peer network. And that actually is a fine illustration of how well these structured networks work. You can actually do away with trackers, and that certainly also leads to, you know, the Pirate Bay and other trackers have been taken down by legal means over time, and that's possible with trackerless systems that is less of a point of attack. One shouldn't, though, make the mistaken thought that this is a secure system, because it isn't. It was not built from the beginning to be a secure system. It's completely out in the open what goes on. So people, it's fairly straightforward to track what people are doing in the BitTorrent system. There are extensions to the protocol that ensure it does do encryption. And this is not only to keep the lawyers at bay, but also, you know, if 35 or half your traffic as an ISP is being used on BitTorrents, you might want to have, you know, a desire to throttle down a little bit on that, so other people can do their Skype talking and you know, sending photos to grandma and stuff like that, you know, legal stuff. And therefore, there's a lot of traffic shaping going on at ISP, so that they throttle down the traffic done by BitTorrent. And trying to defeat that, people are encrypting the traffic so that it's not immediately recognizable as BitTorrent traffic. And I think it's only 2 weeks ago I saw a new product, hardware networking expensive thingy for ISPs that purported to be able to detect this encrypted BitTorrent traffic so that you can still throttle it down to acceptable levels. Because, of course, these systems can use, when it comes to bandwidth use, it's okay, how much these systems can use whatever you've got for bandwidth. It's also interesting as a peer-to-peer network in that it's, I think, one of the very few of these systems that that are clearly for file distribution that have found a number of real uses of white hat uses and are being built into all sorts of systems where people, companies want to distribute big files, video, for instance, and they soon discover that the bandwidth costs are actually pretty heavy when you want to distribute a lot of stuff to people. So if you could get your customers to distribute it for you and perhaps not even pay them for doing that, that would be kind of nice. So in that aspect, BitTorrent is finding its uses. There are some extensions to podcasting where people are using BitTorrent clients to distribute the MP3 files and so forth. So there are a number of situations where people are using BitTorrent for legitimate reasons. Looking at some of these characteristics, this is certainly a good example of a scalable system where people can. Where we definitely have a situation of the more the merrier, and it alleviates the stress on the central seeder if a file is popular. Worst case is nobody is interested in your stuff, and then you have to pay the bandwidth bill yourself, but what the heck, it won't be that expensive then. And if it becomes popular, then you're protected because you will be offloading all the upload costs to everybody else. They will be shared among the people who are involved, and you only get to pay a price bandwidth-wise if you're actually participating in downloading a particular file. So it's not like you're a relay on the network for everybody else's traffic. Of course, if you're doing the trackerless stuff, then I would assume that you are participating in the search for the routing the routing of queries for pieces. But apart from that, all the heavy downloading you will not participate in unless you are downloading yourself. All these lovely hashes makes it easy to integrity check files, which is a nice feature. But anonymity, deniability, censorship, resistance, all that jazz, nah, not really. That's not the avenue to go, as some people have already discovered at their cost, if you want to be safe from legal persecution and stuff like that. And certainly trackers can be shut down. So, let's see, so going to be sender, yay. Given that, the last paper of today is a system than rather than trying to do this tit for tat thing that you give me some of the file and I'll give you some of the file stuff like that, as BitTorrent does in a fairly simple fashion, tries to do something a little more elaborate. Also because in this peer-to-peer system, we are dealing with peers that stay on the network and perhaps collaborate for a lot of different files. So it's not on a per-file. We're not based on only looking at how people behave on one file. We're interested in their behavior over time. The nice thing about the error system is that it is able to have a high probability of high security and establishing trust and accountability without having to resort to a central authority. And there's one paper in the compendium that you have not been required to read. That is an example by Gupta and Al, which is an example of a system with a centralized authority. But I thought this one was nicer, so we'll just look at that one. The general idea is that peers in the systems are selfish. They will always act in their own self-interest, and that security is not absolute, but it's probabilistic. So with a high probability, you will get caught if you try to cheat, and you will then, with extreme high probability, be punished. And that it's not only are you acting in your own self-interest, but it's in your own self-interest to be vigilant, to ensure that other people are not not cheating, because if they do, they will they will have to cheat by telling bad things about you, and you of course don't want that, because you want to maintain your own good reputation. The basic concept is that whenever a peer has been doing a bit of downloading or uploading, that's a transaction. And these transactions are, you can think of them as receipts. They are kept for posterity, for some given time. The transactions are used to calculate the credit value of a given peer, which then is the sum of the uploads minus the downloads. So we can see that people, you know, ideally should be uploading at least as much as they're downloading. These transactions are not kept, or they are obviously they are certainly kept at the peer that has, you know, been participating in these transactions. So if it's uploading stuff or downloading stuff, it has a transaction about it. But these transactions are also distributed to the so-called interested peers. And interested peers are peers with which this particular peer has had transactions with previously for some given time. So everybody will distribute, at least within this closed circle, will distribute their transactions to everybody else. And these transactions are signed. Everybody here has public-private keys, are signed, so that you can verify that a given peer has indeed you know, validated that this transaction has taken place. And if two peers, Bob and Alice, have been exchanging files, well, then they are interested in one another, and they are also interested in that they both publish the truth about these transactions, because Bob might claim that, oh, I uploaded 20 megabytes to Alice, so I get good credit, whereas reality may be that the file was only 5 megabytes big or something, and as these 20 megabytes claimed by Bob would count against Alice.
It is in Alice's self-interest to ensure that Bob is telling the truth. So Bob and Alice publish these transaction records to everybody when they have done their little thing. They publish the credits and they publish the list of interested parties and our peers and share that with all the interested peers. And then credits audit can take place. And credit audit is when a peer checks whether or not the claimed credit reported by a given peer is that which other peers believe it to be. So Alice could, for instance, ask a number of peers among the interested and request that they send off they send her the credits that they know about, the credit they believe is due Bob. And obviously these credits should be consistent, otherwise there's something phony going on. But if Alice and Bob has been having a transaction, Bob will have to tell the truth to Alice, because Alice can right off the bat detect that, you know, if Bob has made fraudulent claims, then Alice can tell that right off the bat. But if Bob wants to improve his standing among the other peers, he has to make the fraudulent claim to those guys. And that means that he claims to have higher credit than he really has. But that can easily be caught with the credit audit, because we ask everybody, or at least just some of the peers among the interested, what is Bob's credit at a given time, and those numbers better match up, otherwise Bob is in trouble. And the funny thing is, of course, that Bob has signed all these credit statements with his signature. So he cannot escape that he must have signed them, and therefore he's caught red-handed trying to game the system. Another basic approach to check that Bob is behaving nicely is to make sure that the transaction that he is publishing to everybody are actually consistent. And again, you select randomly a number of peers among the interested and request that they send you Bob's published transaction for some specific transaction records, or just all the transaction records that Bob has published recently. And again, we just compare these transaction records as they are published, as they have been received by other people. And once again, they have been signed by Bob, so if they're not consistent, Bob is again in trouble. Another possibility, because, okay, we can't really cheat across the interested peers, because if we do so, these audits will catch them sooner or later, and you can increase decrease the interval within which audit is taking place, increase the number of peers that are inquired, and so make it highly unlikely, and there are calculations for the likelihood that cheating can take place. So you can't really cheat within the interested peers list. But what you might conceivably do was then to maintain several lists of interested peers. So, you know, some bunch of people, you're telling the truth because those are the guys you have been doing transactions with, so you can't lie to them because they would know. But then you got some other peers that you want to impress with all your fine credits, and them you tell lies. But to combat that, to make sure that everybody has the same list of interested peers, there's also a possibility of selecting to do a interested peer list audit, and in that case you select a number of peers among the interested and just ask whether you are on, say, Bob's list. And if you're not, well, then you retrieve the list and then you go through the list from everybody and to see again, to check for inconsistencies. And once again, this list has been signed by Bob, so if he's lying or being inconsistent, he is in trouble. And the point here is that you publish a whole lot about your activities, and you publish that to people with whom you do traffic. So they have a very strong interest to keep you honest, because if you're not being honest about your traffic, then you're hurting them by hurting their traffic, their credit rating. And all these audits will check over time, ensure that there are no inconsistencies among the transactions being published by the peers. And if inconsistencies crop up, well, then there's something wrong. And a misbehavior report can then be filled, which contains all the evidence, and this is the beauty of it, is that it's all signed by the offender, so it can be verified that this must be signed by Bob, because he's the only one who can sign it, because he's signing it with his private key. Everybody can verify it with Bob's public key. And then this misbehavior report is published to all the interested peers. If they want to do their own independent study whether Bob is being set up by Alice or whatever, they can do so. But otherwise, this misbehavior report is then used to blacklist Bob, and Bob will be out in the cold. If someone is issuing queries about I, then for a later point, they will get this misbehavior report, which is kept by the interested peers, or suddenly disinterested peers. And this will spread the blacklisting of Bob, so that peers who are various interested peers groups will of course overlap, and over time these misbehavior reports will spread across the network. So with this approach, the reason I think this is an interesting system is that it facilitates reputation and good behavior in a peer-to-peer system, and does so without central authority. Of course, there is some central authority, because there has to be a signing authority so that we have each our public and private key. But that's a part of the general internet infrastructure, if you will, and could probably be supported in a scalable manner. Using just probabilistic methods, this is not completely 100% guaranteed to work, but using probabilistics, it becomes unlikely that one can keep cheating in this system without other people becoming aware of it. There is, of course, some overhead, because all these transactions are distributed across the network. On the other hand, when we are dealing with large media files, the cost is quite insignificant in comparison, because the transactions records aren't very big. And according to the paper, we're dealing with approximately a background traffic of 155 bytes per second in order to ensure a 98.5 detection rate, and that's pretty neat. And of course, you have to probably have a good cryptographic library in your system, because you will be signing and signing and signing everything. But it highlights the things that you can do with proper private cryptography, and the value of being able just to sign stuff to validate that it is indeed you who has performed this transaction, and the usage that exists with catching people cheating, because they have to publish it, and everybody can easily, when they get these transactions, they can verify right off the bat, oh yes, Bob has signed this. They don't make any claims or investigation with regard to validity, unless they are directly involved at a given time, but they can off the bat verify that this is signed by Bob and store it off for later use. So if we take a look at the sum of characteristics of this system, well, scalability is not something that this system is especially designed for, but on the other hand, by not having any central authorities to maintain reputation, they have a pretty decent, they have a possibility of having pretty good scalability. And as I said, 155 bytes per second, if their numbers are to be trusted, it's not too bad. It's certainly ultra fair system. Cheaters will be caught and will be punished in this system. So everybody is supposed to be on their best behavior. When it comes to anonymity, deniability, censorship resistance, and so forth, that's not really the goal of the system. It's there to ensure that everybody contributes fairly to the system, and that people who contribute a lot are, credited for the good work that they do. You should keep in mind, though, that the certificates that are being used, the proper private keys, are not necessarily tied to human identities. You certainly, everybody keeps an eye on you in the system. You could presumably try to attack such a system with pseudo spoofing, where you just generate a lot of fake identities. But in order to get the really good stuff going for you in this system, you have to have high credits. And in order to get high credit, you have to operate on the network for a long time. So just using identities and throwing them away would probably not do you too much good. If we are to draw some conclusions from the systems that I've told you about today, is that in general, when we're talking just general distributed systems and internet, reputation, trust, security, it's all hard, it's very difficult, and you know, you should definitely should keep that in mind when you're dealing with anything over the internet. There are a number of very good techniques, cryptography and so forth, that you can use. Many of them in modern use are based on some sort of signing authority. And then if you are relying on a signing authority, well, then you're relying on, or if you're relying on a system which has the signing authority as its basis, well, then implicit you are relying on the certification authority, the central authority, and that's of course is a question whether you can do that. And of course in peer-to-peer systems we want to do away with central authority, we want to have things decentralized. That's something that you can do by spreading the trust around, by ensuring that everybody documents what they do, or ensuring that people are rewarded for doing good on the system. Some ways of doing this involves, you know, signing everything and making everything pretty much watertight. That's the ARA approach. And other systems, you know, BitTorrent, are just, you know, judging you as we go along for this single file. If you're contributing, you'll get more, and so forth. The BitTorrent system is a little special in comparison with some of the other systems, in that it's only for a file-to-file basis. Other systems, such as FreeSpace or the ARA systems, you're expected to be along for the ride for a longer time. And of course, these various systems touch in all possible directions. You know, whether it's censorship proof or just ensuring that people are well behaved on the network, those are two different aspects. And that basically concludes this talk, which of course was not finished in the lecture hall, but what can you do?